dream as yourself. Like if you dream of a house, you're all the rooms?
That sounds hopelessly egotistical. I.
Wasn't it Jung?
Julia had made some notes about that.
And the night proceeded. Camille and Susan shared their stories, though Julia did not. The lemon souffle was devoured and the wine emptied to the last drop. As Julia cleared the table after they left, she turned up the music. Etta James singing At Last filled the kitchen. And through the open door to the back garden, spring tree frogs seemed to pick up the beat, screeching into the night. My love has come along. Not a chance, Julia thought. She sang, too, her voice trembly, but full of vibrato. Muse. It would be a pity to quit Margaret, as Colin suggests. Why does he come up with this idea? Because she made him edgy. Because she stared at him. Because she ridiculed others, so he knew she ridiculed us? Because she flew in the face of any accepted idea. If I did shred her pages, she would be bits of oblivion. She who was vivid. She who was driven. Also, damn it, she who left me the money to have this freedom to write, just as I was on the edge of returning to the U.S. for a teaching job. I would have kept the house, thanks to what's left of the poetry prizes and my inheritance. I could rent to colleagues and friends, still spending summers here. I don't like someone sleeping in my bed. A first-world problem, I know. But one's own creative life is important, too. And to give over 2/3 of my life a year would dampen the spirit. I've taught before. Rewarding, at times. But you do walk into class, open the silver faucet in your throat, and the lifeblood pours out around your feet. Magically, the students do not notice. For now, Margaret stays. What kind of name is that, Miss Kit Raines? Those were the first words Margaret ever spoke to me. Soon after I bought my Gone to Ruin place in Tuscany in 2003, I was invited to dinner at the apartment of two expatriate Greek women, both translators, stylish in a vintage way, and given to quoting poetry, which endeared them to me immediately. We'd met when they introduced themselves in line at the porchetta stand. The Greek women, Ritsa and Vasiliki, lived in an apartment in a vast palazzo. The dining room walls and ceiling were covered with frescoes from the time of Napoleon's invasion. A bit funky, the formal table held a line of candles stuck in wine bottles, a taverna moment. Everything was set out on the sideboard, and we served ourselves. A hearty vegetable stew and lamb chops. Cold salads with feta, other cheeses, and mounds of fruit. It was a hot night. A pitiful little fan put out a hint of breeze. I was introduced to the other guests. Novelists, oh God, Muriel Spark and her partner. William Weaver, the translator, a nonfiction writer whose name I didn't get, a journalist from Torino, and Ricardo, now my friend, and the only one left who knew Margaret. Suddenly I realized that a colony of writers lived in these hills that I thought I'd discovered. One guest was Margaret Merrill, a writer I had long admired. She'd moved to San Rocco about 20 years ago, after living for years in Sicily and Rome. I knew she was in the vicinity and wondered if I'd ever meet her. I was awed by the company, interested in the Sapphic Greeks, and drawn to Margaret Merrill, who wrote about clandestine, convoluted political situations, the raucous lives of workers, women in black, children,
and about the insidious infiltration of the Mafia into everyday life. I'd read only one of her political books, In the Cold Shadow. What those kinds of informative, investigative books cost the writer. They're published, make a splash or not, and inevitably they drop into an abyss. But her luminous fiction dazzled me. An original, for sure. She reminded me of Marguerite Duras, Juna Barnes, Jean Rees. That elliptical style, the power of suggestion. Here she was, taking delicate bites, sipping wine, the woman who chose to live in severest inland Sicily, driving the pen across page after page, recording the toughness, humor, and cunning of the dirt poor. When I read La Branda, the novel that percolated up from the ruined post-war South, I knew it was one of those blessed books that I would reread, teach from when I had to, and pass around to friends. In it, she wrote about a love affair that never could work, married man thing. But she intertwined the romance with the stories of three families. Their lives were desolate and hard, their humanity shining and strong. She exposed the almost norm of incest. Little girls were fair game for fathers and uncles. Margaret wrote unsparingly, brutally, of the push-pull of the foredoomed love affair and also the fatidic lives. I flashed on her as a great eagle staring down from an eyrie. It struck me with the same power as James Agee's Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, a book it resembles in its penetration of a time and place. Her photographs matched her prose, reserved and stark. Come to think of it, she must have been influenced by Agee. Shall I ask her? I always will associate the color blue with Margaret. She's wearing a gossamer voile shirt with a blue evil eye medallion around her neck. She has the dead level gaze that I associate with the words steely intellect. When she was young, those lowered eyelids must have been considered smoldering. Now they looked slightly Tortugan. I venture, I just wondered, are you influenced by James Agee?
I certainly hope not, she snaps.
Do I see a hint of a smile?
He's a bit sincere for me.
The way she said sincere, it almost dripped. She quickly turns back to the famous translator beside her. Damn. I look down into my salad and cross my eyes. By the time the pistachio gelato comes around, a dozen empty wine bottles stand on the table. I join in where I can, but this is a lively group of old friends, almost like a family gathering. I was often chosen in Red Rover, Red Rover for my ability to break into the linked arms. Together they started migrating from Rome during the terrorist years of the Red Brigades and high mafia years, and on into the 1980s. They settled in abandoned houses and palazzo flats they picked up for nothing and restored. The Greeks haven't restored much. Bits of fresco sift down onto the table. Margaret talks about her research trips to Bulgaria and Russia. She's followed. Her room is bugged. A shadowy man on the midnight train to Sofia. A woman, whose name I didn't catch, talks about a family dispute over publication of her grandfather's correspondence with Winston Churchill. Oh, those papers left behind. What grenades they become. Note to self, burn all diaries before rigor mortis sets in. As the party breaks up, Margaret asks about my name. Well, it's Catherine, of course. Catherine always was my grandmother, so I became Kit. Impulsively, I ask her to dinner on Sunday. Impulsively, because I have no furniture and few dishes, only a rudimentary kitchen with a couple of pots and pans. I do have my mother's silver. I pick up a blue-checked cloth at the market to cover a stained marble table the previous owners left behind in the garden. Let's hope the ground stays dry so the table won't sink. Best keep it simple. Spinach crepe, bought in town. Chicken breasts rolled with prosciutto, roasted asparagus, and fruit. Covered and set with the flowers, the table looks quite inviting. Anything would, really, under a pergola dripping with blooming jasmine. Margaret, I learn, completely restored a ruined tower attached to a small stone house. Her writing room at the top of the medieval lookout affords her 360-degree views of primo Tuscan landscapes. From her early Italian years working with the post-war American Renewal Foundation in Sicily, where she oversaw a team of teachers and ended up directing the rebuilding of bombed schools, post-war lasted a long time in the South. She has solid technical knowledge of structures, as well as the foibles and habits of workers. She was her own contractor. My innocence, ignorance, must be alarming to her. Margaret slightly hesitates before she speaks, as though she might reconsider what she's about to say. But then she lunges in. Right away, she starts correcting my Italian. Please, you must not say Giovanni. Say Giovanni. Accent on Vanni. She makes you feel that you're being watched. Judged? Probably. But I can tell she likes me. You always read of a twinkle in the eye, but she's the first person I've met who has one. She borrows copies of my poems. Long dinner under the jasmine, Margaret blowing smoke rings at the moon, me wedging my knee against the table to keep it from sinking. She starts to sing Blue Moon in a moody voice. I sit very still. She goes somewhere. Where? I'm intrigued. She's a writer like me, single, foreign country. My future? Well, my future does not include the CIA or whatever the Italian Secret Service is, as is whispered about her. At the get-go, washing up after she leaves, I know that my sorrow about my mother's fate lifted in Margaret's presence. Mother Muse. Where's Colin at this point? He's floating out in the ether where we don't know each other. It will be almost 2 years before he'll pack for Florence, where his London architectural firm has landed an extensive restoration project. As he arrives there, I'll fly in from home, where I've finally settled my mother's estate. Colin and I board the same bus into town, and our futures reposition. Margaret refuses to fall into the straightforward narrative I intend. Oh, it's me. Who can say it's I? Just beyond my grasp is a link. And is there a connection to find with the three women who've lighted in the branches nearby? I expect her to remain stolidly Margaret, unto herself. Sandcastle. Unbelievable. Susan, this is spectacular. Julia slid the huge pot of beef bourguignon onto the kitchen counter. Camille struggled with her roll-on and a sack of vegetables. At the door, Susan dropped grocery bags and began opening shutters, letting in the white spring sunlight and the tang of salt air. The kitchen, open to the dining and great rooms, had sweeping views of dunes, beach, and ocean. It's always such a big, big relief to be here, she said. I love this place. My whole family does. did.
She opened double doors onto a porch with rockers and a swing. The sound of breaking waves filled the room. Archie, who'd slept the whole way over to the coast, began to bark.
It always seems impossible that you can be unhappy where tides lull you to sleep, and you open your eyes in the morning to those smeary purple sunrises over the ocean. Amazing! It happens every day.
They made another trip to Susan's car, retrieving Julia's pot of vegetable soup that only sloshed a little in the trunk, various beach bags, the lemon cake Camille baked, and Susan's box of special teas and coffee beans. Camille wasn't surprised at the sloshing. Susan passed two or three cars at once, swerving back as an oncoming car loomed. Camille had noticed Julia, too, casting a glance at the speedometer as it wavered around 85 miles per hour.
"Aren't there speed traps around here?"
Camille finally asked. She wondered if perhaps Susan had a reckless streak.
"I know this road like the palm of my hand. The cops are only out on Sundays along here."
"I don't know the lifeline on your palm. I'm hoping it's not short," Julia joked.
"Okay, my girls always fuss at me."
Susan got the message and slowed to 75.
"We're not going to starve, are we?"
Julia wiped up the mat in the trunk with paper towels. They'd stopped at Harris Teeter for crabs, wine, and cheeses. After she settled Julia and Camille in their bedrooms, Eva and Caroline's rooms, just steps from the sand, Susan proposed a long beach walk, lunch, and a rest. Friday, Saturday, Sunday. 3 days. Susan had a wild idea she wanted to bring up. She also planned to tackle Aaron's office and the storeroom if she felt motivated. She thought she could be quick with the two file cabinets stuffed with yellowed receipts for washing machine repair, trash pickup, and driveway paving. More onerous, storeroom shelves full of deflated beach rafts and mildewed duvets. Could she ever sell Sandcastle? Eva and Caroline hardly ever visit, and when they do, they might stay a long weekend. Her younger brother Mike sometimes brings his family up for a week in the summer. Sometimes her cousin Mary and her partner drive up from Atlanta. Has the life seeped out of the place? Occasionally, Susan drives over alone for a few days. Archie chases gulls and runs like mad on the beach. He has to be washed down after every outing, otherwise his hair turns stiff with salt. A year ago, she brought lanky Willis Sherman, whose house she sold when he divorced, to Sandcastle for Easter weekend. His wife, at age 65, up and left him for the lawn maintenance contractor. The wife, Willis told Susan, said she'd been happy enough with him until the contractor made her laugh. They'd had coffee, then more, and soon she was filing for what she jubilantly called a silver divorce. Willis wasn't vitally wounded. After the sale of his house closed, he began to ask Susan out for dinner. She enjoyed his mild company, his flashy bow ties, and his thin-lipped self-sufficiency, which apparently had driven the wife crazy. Fine with Susan, she wanted no permanent appendage. Going out with him was a distraction. And then she brought him here, wondering if she wanted to get to know him better. If she'd toyed with the idea of sleeping with him, she saw the minute he walked in her door that nothing of the sort was going to happen. He seemed like a looming, strange interloper in her sanctuary. His sharp, pointed nose made him look like a giant pelican. He picked up the family's shells in the big glass bowl, and she squelched herself from saying, "Don't touch those." She showed him to the back guest room, not wanting him in the girls' quarters. He was fine. They had a quiet weekend playing Scrabble and watching movies.
She overlooked his baggy shorts and ugly sandals that revealed yellow talon toenails. He liked the dog and the beach walks. Turned out he made a delicious margarita. She never again answered when his name came up on her phone. Now Sandcastle feels inhabited. Camille compliments her on the blue and white great room, with its iCat patterned chairs, sisal rug, and octagonal coffee table stacked with travel books and fashion magazines. Julia loves the long trestle table and the sleek kitchen with nothing on the counters. Susan sees through their eyes how fresh and inviting the house still is, not just a repository of memories. Julia unpacks her few things, and for the first time in 3 days, checks her messages. Automatically, she deletes ones from Wade, only two this time, without opening them. Her friends tried to reach her for the first month after she sped out of town, but she never responded, and finally they stopped writing, except for the occasional, "hoping to see you soon." She was a scandal, but she doesn't care. She'll reach out to them later, she tells herself. One text from her dad. Only he knows the whole story. He's snug in his glass-walled condo on the Savannah River. His text, only a brief, "miss you." But here's a message from Allison, her next-door neighbor. Maybe there's something about Lizzie, who'd always loved Allison's menagerie of a house. Allison's kitchen smelled like orange marmalade and spice cake. She reads quickly, "Dear Julia, I am missing you today. We just got a new dog, Shaggy Unholy Mix, who loves to slobber and jump all over you. I'm saying this, my friend, because I don't know what to say. Heaven knows you had reason to leave. I'm sure you know people knew about him. Wade looks abashed and miserable. Bet you hope he is. I can understand that you want to cut everything off. Just hope it's not forever, Wade or no Wade. I wish I had something good to tell you, but I've seen no sign of life at your house, except for W's coming and going. Miss you, Allison." Delete. She misses her dad. At 86, he loves to cook, play tennis, and collect two things, hot pepper sauces and paintings of boats. "Daddy," she texts, "I'm at a North Carolina beach with two new friends. It's great. Talk next week. Hugs." If I can muster the strength, she thinks, I'm going to tell Susan and Camille. Archie takes off as soon as Susan steps out the door. Fast as his legs can go, he runs toward the waves, plows in and tumbles, rolls in the sand, shakes, then scampers and yelps at sandpipers. Mindlessly elated, he darts and speeds back, barking at their heels. "What's wrong with you? Why aren't you splashing and twirling?" The three women walk to the end of the island, where four houses are sandbagged against erosion. "That must hurt," Camille says, their investment down the drain. "Who would buy these dangerous mansions?" "It's really sad. Parts of the beach are washing away. Lots of people are planting grasses, hauling in big rocks, putting up those flimsy fences to hold in the sand, but the island still slips away more every year. We're lucky our house sits on a slight rise. I've toyed with the idea of selling Sandcastle. Not because of the water level, we're safe for 50 years. It's just, it's not the invigorating place it used to be for me. I love being here with you, but normally I come alone. I eat a lot of ice cream out of the carton and watch stupid TV. Gardening in sand isn't fun. I do still adore the long walks, the peace." On those home alone weekends, She felt sometimes that the house was breathing and she was not. The house held in all the past, while she was fading into a nebulous future.
You have plenty of time to decide, Camille says.
Yes, we'll revive it with you. Ask any time. Julia laughs. The wide, empty beach, a boon and a gift. She feels like bounding into the surf herself, and would if it were not 60 degrees with a sharp-edged breeze coming up.
Susan continues, good. Really, I can't imagine not having it. The house sits on my interior map of me. If I erased it, there'd be a big gap.
If you need to, that's one thing. If you don't, Camille trails off.
You know, I sold the business, and Aaron was smart enough to have a fat life insurance policy. Not that we ever saved that much. We spent everything, but I've been lucky that he was so responsible. If I let this house go, I could give the girls enough that they could afford 2 dinky places in California, where everything costs the earth. You can't imagine the rent they pay for dreary 1-bedrooms.
She doesn't say that she awakened early this morning thinking of hammering a "Ware Properties for Sale" sign next to Sandcastle's mailbox. In that half-awake state, she'd happily banged the stake into the sand, because she thought for a moment that she had someplace else she really wanted to go, though she wasn't sure where.
As they turn back, facing the wind, roiling clouds move across the sky. They step up their pace. By the time they reach Sandcastle, cold drops begin to splat on their heads. Julia can't find where she'd left her sandals, and then she spots Archie at the walkway, gnawing the delicate straps.
Susan turns on the gas log to take the chill off the great room. Not one for hauling wood. She had it installed after Aaron died. Julia towel dries her fine, springy hair, pushing it into curls. Susan brings over to the hearth a pot of bergamot tea and a plate of Camille's lemon cake slices. Camille's longer hair hangs in bedraggled strands, but Susan's good shortcut just looks sharper, slicked and pointy.
45 minutes, Julia says, stirring potatoes and carrots into the beef so they'll be done when she pulls her rich stew out of the oven.
They all put on sweaters. Slanted rain batters the windows. Out at sea, branches of silver lightning fork and pierce the water.
Thanks for arranging this dramatic event. Julia smiles.
Thunder rumbles the house all the way down to the foundation.
Susan tosses Julia a cloud-soft throw.
Are you freezing?
Rain at the beach always seems bone-chilling.
She passes the cake, and no one demurs or says anything about it being too close to dinner. In the lamplight on the bookcases, the big window reflecting the women around the fire, Camille luxuriates. For the first time in a year, she doesn't feel as though she would float off if she were not tethered. She catches the sudden mysterious sparkle on the ceiling as her engagement ring flashes light. For so long, she's looked for signs of Charles's presence. Stupid, she knows. Julia wraps herself into a blue mohair blanket. She sips slowly Susan's tea with its hint of bitter orange.
I think this is the only moment I've felt no tension in my shoulders since I hightailed it out of Savannah.
She smiles broadly. This easy happiness lifts her, illuminating her dark blue eyes that always look slightly surprised.
You look beautiful right now, Susan says. Your eyes are the color of the lapis lazuli ring my mother wore, that same depth of blue.
Oh, thanks. I think we all look a bit redeemed by today. I'm happy to be here with you two.
Julia puts down her cup. Suddenly emboldened, she says,
I'm not sure we're ready for this. You've both been forthright, and I know I haven't.
I'd like to try to tell you about what has been going on with me.
Hey, don't worry. You are under no obligation to dig up the past for us.
Camille loves it that Archie has leapt onto her feet and begun to snooze. Thunder pounds through the house.
Christ, it's going to shake the fillings out of our teeth,
Susan cries out. Camille is not sure she's up for Julia's story. She senses that it isn't going to be pretty, and she is relishing this respite from gnawing grief. But Julia continues,
It's hard. Hard. But I do want to say a few things. Not to burden you, my saga could sink the weekend.
Julia smiles.
I know this will sound twisted, but I've almost envied the two of you. Your husband's died. Awful to say. But in these months I've been in Chapel Hill, I often have wished mine had. Oh, God, it would be so clean. I'd be left in a clear space, at least with him.
Susan's mouth drops slightly open. Camille rolls her lips in, as she does when speechless, but neither says anything. Julia exhales a long, whistling sigh.
Can I do this?
Julia, no, don't worry. Only if you want. We're having a fine time, and no one thinks we need to rush things, right, Susan? Camille pours more tea. Susan brings over three glasses and a bottle of her usual Sauvignon.
To hell with tea. I, for one, would love to get down to it, Julia.
You often seem distraught. I'm sorry. So distracted. And, oh, lovely. I would like to know your story ASAP. Maybe it actually would help.
So, Camille thinks, Susan is one to cut to the chase. She wasn't sure she liked that. They are three in firelight, the storm waning, the beef bourguignon simmering in the oven. Later, Susan will toss the salad. Camille will prepare a cheese plate. Susan has set the table with her shell placemats and Aaron's generous breathe-in-the-aroma wine glasses. And now, the fire and the wine and the tentative voice of Julia and the storm moving away.
Maybe the first thing to say is that I have a daughter, Lizzie.
Where is she? Susan asked, thinking of her two sweet ones, both far away in California.
Well, that's the big horror. I don't know right now. I think in San Francisco. She's addicted to, well, cocaine and prescription drugs for sure, and probably heroin again, the worst. Let me back up. My husband is Wade Tyler. He's in Savannah. Oh, I never changed my name. I kept my name, Hadley. That became an issue later, but Wade didn't mind at first. Later, he said, part of me never married. I'm still thinking about that.
Both Susan and Camille frown, then smile encouragingly, not knowing what to expect next.
Back to Lizzie. We had this hideous incident last fall. Opioid OD, the hospital chart said. That's opiates, like what the dentist gives when your wisdom teeth are pulled. You feel nice and woozy.
Oh, yes, Camille remarks. I liked the Percocet after my knee surgery.
When you're addicted, it's another story. Her meds were oxycodone and Xanax. She swallowed a full bottle. Her roommates, as addled as they usually are, got her to the emergency room. She survived. To go back to the beginning, Lizzie started on drugs when she was in high school. They say marijuana isn't a gateway drug, but for her, it was. She told me once that she took to it right away. One boozy party with pot, and she says, "That's for me." I hate talking of her this way. You'll only know her as this pathetic junkie. When she was small, she was bright and curious. A little buttercup who loved clay and books and horses lined up on the windowsill. We had the best life. I'll never forget that, anyway. I have 15 pure gold years in a jewel box in my head. Wade is one of the chosen. If I believed in God, I'd say he was blessed. Every part of him is beautiful, down to his toes. I was the luckiest girl in Savannah, believe me. This sexy husband, this smart little girl who liked princess costumes and puzzles of the world. Now I don't even know if I still love her. I think I don't. I love the she before she became who she became, this inflated monster of my lovely daughter. But I can still glimpse Lizzie, who's always there. When we were out walking today, I thought of her at St. Simon's, where we used to go in summer. She loved body surfing, finding sand dollars. A little love. We always had such great times with her. Camille shifts under her throw and Archie jumps down. She leans toward Julia. Susan puts her hand on Julia's foot. Oh, honey. Flash forward, after the happy jewel box years, to Lizzie's blossoming addiction. You can imagine how we thrashed over what caused her to slide into drugs. There's little to pin it on. Oh, Wade opened the door to her room when we came in early one night and found her half naked with her boyfriend. She was 15. Wade had a flying hissy fit and threatened the poor scrawny boy jumping into his jockeys. I was on the stairs, disbelieving that this adolescent was speeding by me holding his pants and crying, and Wade yelling, "Dirty ass!" Susan and Camille can't help but laugh, and then Julia does too. Wade shook Lizzie by the shoulders and shouted, "Tawdry!" and "Shameful!" He spotted the bong and called her a little idiot. Lizzie didn't speak to him for a week. That sort of thing. Not much. Not often. And we weren't that worried. Most people try pot, grow up, and move on. I know we were good parents. She was adored. I forgot to say, my father is my rock. He doted on Lizzie, as did Mom, who died when Lizzie was 8. He's always been generous to Lizzie. Of course, now, we've made him stop giving her birthday and Christmas money. We stopped long ago. Wade got sick of his hard-earned going for her self-destruction. But then we felt guilty, thinking of her rent, her car insurance. She'd call. Desperate. We gave in many times. I tell you, it's a lose-lose situation. By 11th grade, she started staying out too late, acting surly. We thought it was a stage. Senior year, a respite, she sailed through the SATs, did well in school, and we thought she was fine. Then her freshman year at Emory, she said she wanted to be a doctor. When she came home for Christmas holidays, I thought she looked odd. Her fresh, peachy skin had turned sallow. Even the whites of her eyes looked dull as an eggshell, no shine at all. I suggested girls' lunch, then hair appointments, some shopping for gifts. She didn't want to go, but begrudgingly agreed. I remember we were getting our nails done together, and I looked over at her. Stringy, unkempt hair, circles under her eyes, a listless look. Not even trying to make conversation with the nice Vietnamese woman, and I thought, if she weren't my daughter, I'd think she was a drug addict. Instinct. It just hit me. I talked to Wade, and he agreed that she seemed out of it and alienated. She didn't want to string popcorn for the tree or help decorate. I was worried that she was run down or getting a cold because she was sniffling. Later, I learned that was a prescription drug sniffle. She didn't eat the holiday dinners she used to love. She didn't even buy gifts for anyone. Christmas Eve. We were getting ready to go to my dad's for dinner. She'd left a coat and her handbag downstairs. While she was in the shower, I opened it. Pills. Envelope of pot and a bottle of white powder. I told Wade and he went ballistic and banged on the bathroom door. What the hell is going on? And so forth. Short version, we didn't see her even at spring break until the summer when she arrived home having flunked out. Therapy, community college, therapy, but she kept disappearing. A spiral. Wade was devastated. We both were. And he was really good, trying everything to help. She paused. With only an occasional outburst of anger, which resulted in her going off with some of her seedy-looking friends for days, Wade has what I later learned to call an anger management problem. I was just as mad at her as he was. But I took the helpful, tell me what can I do to help, was so concerned, walk all over me once again approach, which didn't work any better. This is the worst, Julia. Camille feels again her own helpless rage when Charlie got his 17-year-old girlfriend pregnant their junior year. Charles had remained calmer than she, meeting the girl's parents, discussing abortion, adoption, all the impossible options. Then the girl miscarried, and Charlie didn't date for the rest of high school. What a nothing incident in comparison. Julia gets up to stir the beef, then plops back down on the sofa. Well, it gets worse, but I am not going to play this violin much longer. Lizzie quit community college and lost all her Emory friends and even her high school friends, who'd straightened up by then and joined sororities and majored in psychology and pre-law. Next, she went to a small experimental college in Arizona. That didn't work out. She hated the fucking desert. Next, we heard she'd walked away from there and landed in New Orleans. She called saying she wanted to try Tulane and please send tuition money. She was fine now and realized what a mess she had been and she was coming home soon and could we go sailing? We sent the money. Well, guess what? Fast forward. We've got her in rehab 3 times, once without her consent, and that went nowhere. The other 2 times she agreed but left the New Orleans place after 2 weeks of detox. Then it was California. Everything loose rolls west, my daddy says. She stuck with the super clinic outside San Francisco for only a month. She walked out all clean, we thought, insisting she was fine, insisting on not staying another day in that hellhole. And no, she was not coming home. Within 2 weeks, police stopped her as she drove away from a low-life bar with some doofus. They were speeding in more ways than one. The police frisked them. He was arrested for possession of whatever he had. She was held overnight and let go. One more Valentine ripped in half. By this time, we had no denial and little hope left in us. We rushed here and there to help when she hit various walls. Hit them she did. We were plowing the ocean. In San Francisco, she waited tables and worked in a terminal care center and lived with a bunch of other dropouts in a storefront in the Tenderloin, the druggy haven. Now and then, one of her friends would call us and say she was really worried about Lizzie, that she was going home with all kinds of men she met in bars, and AIDS was rampant, that she was having blackouts and didn't remember the night before. Lizzie didn't keep in touch. After all we meant to each other, she was living an alternate reality, totally swallowed by her stupid addiction. We'd had a big life, the three of us. A real life. Julia bites her nail and stares into the fire. We tried tough love, tried being supportive, being non-judgmental. You have no idea how hard that is. Yes, yes, it's the drugs talking. But she's listening. What part of her won't wake up? She's devious, manipulates us, lies. We all three landed in her vicious, vicious cycle. I feel like she's the center of a roundabout, and I have to circle it no matter what direction I need to take. She likes drugs. She doesn't want to quit. Sometimes she does. She cries for hours. She blames everyone but herself. She has this ironic humor. Everything for her happens with quotation marks around it. She maintains that she functions well, and of course she doesn't. She's a smash-up on the freeway. She's 35 now. So, it's been an awfully long haul with all this. When she overdosed in San Francisco, we hardly could admit it to ourselves, but she meant to. She left a note. It said, "I've never spoken this, not even to my father." The note said, "What's the point? There is no point." We were broken in half and terrified. But something else broke, too. I just froze toward her. What's the point? My anger was gigantic, and Wade was about to pop. We tried to act calm. Surely this would be the turnaround of all this madness. We brought her home. She was trembling on the plane and looked like a zombie. She spilled her water. She pressed her forehead to the window, banged it a couple of times. I tried to anchor her with happy memories. Remember that time we flew to New York? It was your first flight, and she stopped me right there. "Do we have to go down memory lane?" We hoped she had hit the proverbial bottom they say you have to hit. We found the best help once again. But she made fun of the doctor, who tried to get her to make a list of things that could inspire her to change. Something in me started to hold back. My illusions were stripped. The weirdest part, I became bored with it. She drank coffee by the gallon and sat by the back kitchen window, rocking back and forth and looking out at the garden. She read self-help books Daddy brought over, then tossed them in the trash. One afternoon, she went out for a walk and came home high and mean, totally unlike the vulnerable rag doll we brought home from the hospital. She'd sold the jewelry my mother left her. We found out later she'd ordered Xanax and Klonopin on the internet. She used Wade's computer. She even took the kitchen money out of the sugar canister.
Being at home was driving her crazy, she let us know. She was taking the first thing smoking on the runway back to San Francisco. That's the last we've seen or heard of her. I found a letter in her wastebasket. It was addressed to Anna Blackwell in San Francisco. I Googled the address. A purple slum house in a not horrible neighborhood. The letter said, I'm heading back. Turn down a bed for me. Then trailed off and she'd thrown it away. When I look at the sky and see contrails dissolving, I think, that's Lizzie. No wonder you love Hugh's quiet, empty house, Camille says. You're brave, really brave, to break away from what's tearing you apart. I guess. But the Wade part? I wasn't brave. When she left the last time, Wade and I were destroyed and wildly relieved and guilty about that. You might say we had our own toxic cocktail going. You'd think we'd cling together, but the opposite happened. We began to give up, maybe on each other as well. Every time I looked at his handsome mug, he reminded me of our failure, and his rants to me against Lizzie became unbearable. All the where-did-we-go-wrong discussions. I couldn't mouth the words anymore. I started working longer hours, loving my job even more than before. Lizzie is the victim of drugs, but you know what? We are her victims. She's about killed our spirits. Sometimes I think she's like someone running randomly, slinging around a sledgehammer. Let it fail whom it will. Did I use whom right then? Camille says yes. Please pour me a big glass of that wine, Susan. The oven dings. They look at each other as if they've been jarred awake. Your famous beef, Camille says. Julia shrugs out from under the mohair throw. Let's have a long dinner. There's more to say, but not at the table. She looks flushed and alert. Okay, Camille thinks. We know the worst. This will be good to get over with, Susan thinks. Susan lights the candles as Camille slices bread. They serve themselves bowls of the rich stew as they talk about dogs, the farmer's market, politics, and cars. The bread is excellent for dipping into the warm broth. Susan leashes Archie and takes him out while Julia and Camille clear up the dinner dishes. The stars are bright again, the moon gone. Before we go to bed, I want to get the shrimp into the marinade, Julia says. She's brought the prepped ingredients in a jar. Delicious shrimp salad, grilled crab, and asparagus. That takes care of tomorrow night quite nicely. Julia, you're a girl after my heart, thinking during one meal of what's for the next. There's plenty of my lemon cake for dessert. We have fresh orange juice. I might make a sorbet. Archie visits his favorite bushes while Susan texts her daughters. At Sandcastle, thinking of selling. What do you advise? Archie dashes to his bed by the fireplace, and the three women decide to call it a day, too. Susan stays in the great room, searching the internet for comps for her house. She's on another mission as well. Camille selects a Joanna Trollope novel off the shelves and heads to her bedroom. She opens the window to hear the receding tide scooching through shells. Julia just wants to sleep. A memory surfaces. Her wedding. A police siren outside the church blaring throughout the entire ceremony. A portent. She has not cried since she left Savannah. Now,
she cries.
Part 3. What do tourists want? Thursday, Colin's on week in London. After years of fierce commuting on Monday and Friday from Florence to London and home, he has enough Italian work to stay at home every other week and all weekends. Still, who likes to commute? I'm a stay-at-home. My life equals my work. My work equals my life. That's why I fit well here. The Italian way. Work to live, not live to work. With so much solitude, I'm bound to accomplish a lot, yes? Well, this is one of the most sociable places on planet Earth. I have to fight for time. There's always something delectable cooking at my neighbors' and friends' houses. Always someone stopping in to drop off chestnuts and ricotta, still warm, and a bottle of homemade vin santo. When Colin's away, I linger longer in town, read more, go to movies, invite girlfriends over for lunch, sometimes join the monthly book group for lunch at Trattoria Donizetti if I've had time to read the Italian novel. The only way I can walk as much as I do every day is by listening to books. I put up with the earbuds that remind me of the plugs I had to wear in the heavily chlorinated pools of my childhood, because the kilometers race by when I'm involved with Hilary Mantel, Edith Perlman, Virginia Woolf, or those scratchy voices of the modernist poets reading their work at the dawn of recording. The trouble is, I often meet people on the roads and must stop, press pause, chat, pet their dog. Today I met Grazia just as I closed my gate. She stopped her car, got out for the ritual kisses, and asked me to go to her house for advice on renting it. Grazia teaches violin at her aunt's house in town. She wears long crepe skirts, scuffed boots, indeterminate tops, and she juts out an ample bosom. For the violin to rest on? Her black bean eyes dart and sparkle. When she smiles, she flashes perfect teeth, refrigerator white. She smiles now. They will surely be Americans. I've put the website into English because the Americans will pay the most. What will they expect? You will know. Please come and tell me. As we step into the foyer, the first thing I say is, air the place out for days. I know all that. I hardly come here since. Two Romanian women will clean head to tail. What do I do to make the American like the house? So someone will want to buy it and I won't have to worry. We walk from room to room. You'd have to be tone deaf and oblivious not to love this place, Grazia. Don't worry. Your parents had lovely things. You might put away some of the china. They're not pleasing to me, the dishes. I prefer my own plain white. She pulls out drawers full of table linens with monograms, oversized silver cutlery, thin platters decorated with fish, some with flowers. All old. She looks bored. Since she grew up here, she doesn't even glance at the dining room fresco that delights me every time I get to see it. She didn't even photograph it on the website advertising the house for rent. Italians do take art for granted. Another reason to love it here. Between the two windows, some fanciful artist created a trompe-l'œil garden scene that must have replicated what you actually saw from the adjoining windows. He, maybe she, painted a balcony with a stone balustrade overlooking boxwood rows, tall topiary balls, and an arching rose arbor covered in white and pink blooms. Rampicante is a word I love. The Italian word has more force than rambling.
All those emphasized syllables impart vigor to climbing roses or wisteria or honeysuckle. A path down the middle of the